Right, well, as Aaron mentioned, it's a spin-off from the previous thought, it's a spin-off from the previous thought, having really worked with Aaron and Carbon Soldiers before, but I thought enough to Aaron and read a lot of literature about how interesting that topic is. And so I wanted to look at it from a different perspective from this what you all are looking at. And so I wanted to add to the title that the molar enthalpies that we're looking at are actually measured using the flow absorption character and not just derived by thermodynamic calculations. What is interesting about chemistry in general is that besides the fact that it gives you a thermodynamic property that is important, which is the delta H of a reaction, oftentimes if you look hard enough in the heat data, it allows you to obtain information about of mechanistic value, especially if you combine it with some other knowledge of the system, mainly spectroscopy. It's just another window or a new window to actually get one more piece of the puzzle, if you will, to fit it together. Flow chemistry, whereby we can talk a little bit more about it, but actually there's an interface, there's a liquid and solid interface, has several advantages, mainly that it affords you the chance to look at heat of a bunch of surface reaction, if you will, but also the fact that using the same sample, you do multiple treatments, and by treatments, I mean experiment, absorption, sorption, pH change, string change, and then you can recover that sample and you can compare the heat or the energetic data to microscopic sample data from the same sample. Minimizes a lot of the handling of the sample between experiments and also, I guess, combining the information from one kind of helps fit together the data better. I forget to mention that these are in-house built chemistry for the last 10 years. We've built several of them, and I mainly work on metal oxides, aluminum, iron, mixed aluminum, iron, titanium, silica. So this kind of ventures into the new carbon area where it's just interesting to actually look at the differences that we might actually see between what we know on pure offsets and the ones that have carbon. So the idea behind our flow system is that there is a stationary phase, and then you flow a solution through it, and there's two pairs of thermistors that are measured, are continuously measuring the temperature of that reaction. Those two thermistors actually form half an electronic bridge that is connected to the outside to the other half, and together they form a Wheatstone bridge that actually outputs the voltage. That voltage is inputted into a magnification board and then into a meter that collects data. So I will continuously monitor the temperature as the system goes on. There is an inlet of solutions. You have several of them, and you have the choice of alternating those solutions back and forth over the same sample that sits inside the column. I should say that the way you get chemistry, obviously, isothermic, but the way you perform the experiment itself is that you obtain a baseline in some sort of effluent or ionic strength solution, and you perturb the system by introducing a reactant. That reactant could be anything in the solution that actually reacts with that surface. So there are two thermistors, as I said. One is a column thermistor that sits very close, tightly packed next to the column, the solid that you're looking at, and another one which is the reference. And so when both of them see the same temperature, which if nothing is happening on the surface of that solid, you just basically have a baseline flowing. And then once you inject a component of interest that hits the solid and it actually does a reaction, if the column thermistors perceive an increase in temperature, you see an exothermic peak, and if it actually sees a drop in temperature, it's an endothermic peak. These are actually integrated over time, but also they're integrated over flow area, which I'll tell you in a minute why. And so you obtain peak areas in both millimeter. These are kind of random numbers for now because they don't give you a value of how much energy goes in that reaction. These actually can be transformed into actually energy millijoules units by an empirical calibration. In the column itself, there's a thermistor, there's a resistor that you energize at known current and voltage, and so you can actually collect what you call heat pulses, and you basically integrate them and you obtain a peak, and so you know basically how much millijoule corresponds to each unit of peak area. It is a very sensitive system, and these are the electronics. We do the heat pulses using a 5-5 thermal circuit that is very precise in terms of the time that gives a heat,
basically a heat pulse. The reason I say it's fluoride, this is how it looks like, because the solution itself is basically driven over the solid by fluoride. It's a drop of 100 centimeter, and it's actually well controlled using basically this little valve here. And we monitor fluoride at all times, because obviously fluoride can affect the rate of the heat that you actually put in or take out. So we measure fluoride gravimetrically, and then everything feeds out, and then it's actually generated on the computer. So the idea behind basically using this, it's been kind of a benchmark reaction in over surfaces of oxides, looking at ionic change, just a simple what we call atmosphere or low energy in a sphere, no matter how you want to call it. Basically, the way we do the experiment, you obtain a flow rate, you obtain a baseline in one of these solutions, let's say 50 millimolar sodium chloride. When you change it to 50 millimolar sodium nitrate, what happens, the nitrate exchanges with the fluoride on the interface, and then you see an exothermic peak. And then if you do the other way around, you take the solution out of the nitrate, put it back in fluoride, chloride temperature basically change with nitrate, it's an endothermic peak. And you can do that all day long. It just goes exothermic, endothermic, exothermic, endothermic. They're very reversible. They are very reproducible over time and sample. Which lets you know a couple of things about the reaction. One, how energetic it is. Some sort of kinetic data, if you will, depending on the shape of the peak, but also how reversible the reaction is. Whether it actually, if the backflow of the reaction actually comes back with a similar peak, it means it's completely reversible. If not, then there's some sort of irreversibility to the reaction. We can do, so this is nitrate exothermic and chloride endothermic. And then we can do the same, basically, if we have several inlets of solution, you can measure basically negative charge on the surface or cation exchange, if you will. By doing some sort of similar experiments, you go 50 millimolar sodium chloride, 50 millimolar potassium chloride. So the only thing changing here are just the cations. It's important when using oxides to keep the pH and the strength of the heat stable, because these have antithetic sites that are reactive with pH and with ionic strength. So some of the kind of benchmark values that we know so far is that anion exchange on aluminum oxide, iron oxide, mixed aluminum iron, almost always range between 3 and 5 kilojoules per mole. Again, these are not standard state delta H, so this is just what we measure in terms of the system itself. And then cation exchange at 1 to 2. These peaks just happen to not be at the same pH, because that surface was not at the right pH to have both. However, you can do that, measuring cation exchange and ion exchange, or positive charge or negative charge, on the same surface at the same pH. So technically what you're looking at, and I know this is a very simplistic way of looking at a surface, and we have evolved way better than that now, but basically what you're looking at is just that surface here. Is that if you detect chloride endotherm or a nitrate exotherm, you're actually looking how much positive charge there is, how much of that charge actually sees the nitrate. And the same way, if you do a sodium, the sodium actually will tell you how much negative charge there is on the surface. At the right pH, you see them both, or you see one of them or another one. The reason why we're pretty confident that that's what we see is because these amphotericic sites, you know, they have different pKa's and different pHs, and so if you change that pH of the solution on the same sample in situ, you actually do see changes in those heats. If you go from pH 5 to pH 10, you see the AEC, which is basically a probe of that positive charge, decrease in basically the area, and then reverse the same thing, and then you start picking up CEC, so you know that actually the OHs are going from being protonated to being deprotonated, depending on what kind of pKa system you want to actually think of. So we've been doing that fairly well, and I guess it's good to know that it works. But so, the rationale, I just talked enough with Aaron to kind of get interested in that whole idea of carbon. And it was, you know, this is what I know, so I said, you know, let me just put them in the parameter and see if you actually see changes in the molar heat. The idea being that the molar heat itself, and no one has asked me before, they usually stop me and ask me, where does the heat come from? Why do you see it exothermic or endothermic? It's because of basically the density of the charge. Sodium is more hydrated than potassium. It likes to be in the water. To put it on that surface, it actually requires energy to be hydrated. So that's why it just goes on the surface endothermically.
when you want to figure out potassium, sodium would be happy to go back in solution. It can already be in there, so potassium is very effective at actually putting sodium out in the solution. So you see a potassium exothermic. Those heats actually are kind of a measure or a probe of the strength of that charge, and that charge actually does change depending on the bond that it's attached to, is the electronic density or configuration of those reactive surfaces. So we just figured that, you know, with all that talk about being co-precipitated, that perhaps we will see a change on molar enthalpies. So I use the same materials, they haven't changed. They just shipped them to me, and I haven't done much characterization besides the fact that we've done BET on them, and actually, just like Aaron said, they decrease in surface area, going from 0.5 to 0. I'm assuming that the right thing to say is that it does increase aggregation, and so we see that as a change in surface area. So I know we did the calorimetric measure. It's a very simple experiment to do, which is basically you measure the heat at chloride, nitrate, and potassium sodium at a certain pH. You integrate, you get flow rate, you put them in millijoules, and then you basically have to analyze for analytically outside the calorimeter for the AEC in centimoles of charge per kilogram, or the quantities of CEC or AEC, and then you can obtain or calculate the molar enthalpies, how much heat for every mole of charge that is exchanged. And this is what we see. So if you, across the board, the blue line is basically a nitrate exotherm. It's indicating a surface positive charge, and the red line is a surface negative charge, even though it's a sodium endotherm. As you basically increase this way, you see with increasing carbon, you're detecting an increase in negative charge, which I guess we suspect it shifts the zero point of charge downward. It might actually start picking up more negative charge. But surprisingly, it also see a slight increase in the positive charge. And I don't want you thinking yet of quantities, because this is just the heat. There are two reasons why we see more heat. It could be just either the process is more energetic, or actually there's more positive. So this is important to keep that separate in mind. We see that on some electrophoretic mobility measurements as well that Aaron has done, where it showed that across the board, at every pH, when you actually increase carbon, you actually increase the negative charge. So there's some sort of support for that. If you look hard enough with your heart, you might look at your abdominal peaks and see that perhaps as you increase the carbon, if you want to interpret it that way, that you start losing some maybe positive component to that zeta potential, and you start picking up as you go to the 0.5 a little bit more of the negative itself. The question is now, so we know that it increases the charge, we know that we've seen it on electrophoretic mobility, but what does it do to the molar enthalpies? And so we take in those peaks and we integrate them in Boltzmann, which is the peak area unit, and you see that there's basically more peak area units. We transfer them to millijoule, and then there's actually more millijoules. This is the point where you're ready for them in molar enthalpies of kilojoule per mole. There's a caveat here that those numbers are, you see there's a lot of basically standard error in them, because the measurement is not as precise as the calorimetric measure. But we actually see delta H's values between 0.5 to 0.15. These are the ones in red because my experience with ferric hydride has been that it's all actually between 3 to 5 kilojoules. So I don't know if actually that change is real or not. However, what's interesting is if you remember here on the AEC that we actually see more heat in the one that has carbon. So why do we see more? I mean, there's no reason why we're going to pick up more positive charge, but it's co-precipitating. Then how is it doing that? It's not sorbing. Even if it is sorbing, then it should actually kill some of those charges. So what we know so far is that we know that it results in increase of the surface negative charge. But how is it doing the positive charge? Why do we see more AEC with actually increased carbon? Plausible scenario, why do we have more surface charge? I'm not quite sure of that one. Perhaps, and that's what I'm thinking of, is that we see an interaction with basically a group that is just highly more energetic. So we don't actually see more charge, we just see more heat for the limited amount of the charge for that action. So what does that say in terms of coordination, that no matter how the carbon is coordinated with that iron, perhaps the reactive sites that are basically in contact with the solution just happen to be slightly different than just a regular OH that actually we know is always between 3 to 5 kilojoules per mole. It could be functional group on that carbon that has a higher pKa, and then because it has a higher pKa, it actually see more charge.
And then again, there's like, and this is where we are, I guess. And then we do next, we actually re-measure those magnitudes, we determine the molar entropies to see if we can actually see if this is real or not. And then the material characterizations, and then we can do different pHs at the same time to actually tease out what is the actually pKa of these OHs that are the active units. Oh, and I heard Peter Nico has really cool images, so we've just been trying to have a picture show off, so I think this is way cooler.